Hey everybody, it's Alec here. Welcome back to the show. And today I have a very special guest today, Justice Earl, who is the founder of the Snapclip. And Justice, first of all, thanks a lot for being on the show today.
Yeah, no problem. My pleasure, Alec.
And I want to know, you know, a lot about your story and this and that and how you got started and the evolution of the product. But before we get all into that, what is the Snapclip? Because I could explain it, but I think you could do a better job of it.
So the Snapclip is a single button remote control for your phone, your tablet, or your laptop. And it's very simple. You just connect it with your device with Bluetooth. And then whatever app is open, the single button remote control operates that app. So if you set up your phone with a video recording app, it'll start and stop video or take pictures. If you have Spotify, Apple Music, Pandora, SoundCloud, anything like that, it will start and stop your music, control the volume, skip through tracks. And it also works with Netflix and Hulu and, you know, YouTube, all the streaming as well.
Yeah, so it's this little button that just kind of clips on, sort of like a Fitbit, and you press it and it can do, you know, different commands based on what you program it to do. Yep. So what do you think are like the most popular use cases? It's 2022, you know, how people are using their phone. What do you think?
Well, so the way we look at it, we talk about the customer journey. We think about it from a design perspective first. So On the cover of the button, we have all kinds of different cool designs, patterns, colors, brand collaborations. So people are drawn to it because it aesthetically looks fun and engaging. And then when people connect it to their phone and they take a picture for the first time, that's kind of their wow moment where they're like, oh my gosh, I'm taking a picture with this little button. It's just a fun experience. And then the daily adoption comes through music. So Americans listen to 4.5 hours of music a day. So for me personally, when I'm steady on the grind, I'm working on my laptop, I don't want to get distracted by looking at my phone. Yeah. So I have my phone down. I don't want to look at the screen. I'm, you know, doing my work and I'm controlling my music with the Snapclip. Then I go to the gym, same thing. You know, I've got a playlist going and I'm doing a big lift. And the song sucks. It's not pumping me up. I skip to the next song without looking at my phone, without having to interact with my phone. So, you know, when I think about user experience and user interface, there's a quote I think of that says the best interface is no interface. And so, you know, our goal is to empower people to with tools to be the best version of themselves. So if you're in the gym, you're training, you're trying to achieve peak performance, you need to have ultimate focus in that moment. And so this very simple, you don't have to look at it. It's one button, you know, you set it and forget it. And you're just cranking through your exercise. You're staying in the flow. You're staying in the moment. And that's our goal, is to help people be the best version of themselves.
Okay, I love that. And I kind of have a hard question for you. It might be difficult, it might not be. Sure. But this is what I do on my AirPods.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's kind of your competition in some sense.
In a way, so the way we look at it, and people say that similarly with like, I've got a smartwatch. Why do I want this? The reality is that those controls are limited, and depending on what you want to do, those controls flat out suck. No. So if, especially if you're doing anything where your fingers are dirty or wet, let's say you have gloves on, you're snowboarding, you're doing anything active like that, your AirPods controls flat suck and they're limited. You can't do all the things you can do with a Snapclip with your AirPods. So we're kind of like a tool belt. You know, we think of ourselves as like Batman's tool belt. You're going to have your AirPods, you're going to have your Apple Watch, you're going to have these different gadgets, but Snapclip helps you do things in scenarios where none of these other gadgets can help. And so it's like, it's an add-on, and at $14.99, it's a no-brainer.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. So, and you just got into retail, right?
Yeah.
So tell me about that. Like, what are the stores? I remember you mentioned one was Best Buy. Is it
Yeah.
just Best Buy? Are there other retailers as well?
Yeah. So it's Best Buy right now.
Okay. And how many stores are you in?
622.
Okay, great. And I want to talk to you about that because I think the audience is definitely curious on, how people could get their own product in the Best Buy or kind of what that journey is like. But before we get into that, upon studying you and, doing some research, like there's been a lot of evolution of this product, right? It started back in 2014,
Yeah.
right? So tell me about that. Like, what has been like your, you can go back as far as you want, but like, what's your journey been like as an entrepreneur?
So I was at a tech company in Silicon Valley. We were one of the first companies to bring the Internet of Things to the solar industry. So when I got to the company, we had basically just a couple prototype systems in California. And by the time I left the company, we had, I think, 4 million internet connected solar panels across 7 continents. So when we came to that industry, we told the industry, hey, look, this industry is outdated. Solar panels are very simple construction. There's no electronics. And we're a Silicon Valley company bringing internet electronics to the solar industry. And so we had to disrupt that industry. We had to prove our value. We had to get to make a power electronics product that would last on a roof, a very hostile environment, for 25 years. And then we had to get that cost down so that you're already buying this expensive solar system, and now you're buying an add-on electronic to it. And our CEO had previously, he'd come from Intel, and he'd seen firsthand, he was front row seat to watching the smartphone industry blow up. And Nokia was one of Intel's biggest customers. And so our CEO, before he's a CEO of the solar company, he was going to Finland. He was talking to the CEO of Nokia, and he was saying, look, smartphones, they're going to take over the planet. And Nokia was like, no, they're not. We don't care. We're Nokia. They had like 53% market
And what
share.
year was this?
I don't remember. I mean, it must have been, it was before, like right around the launch of the iPhone or something.
Like 2007 or something like that.
Yeah, so maybe something like that. Anyway, so Nokia was asleep at the wheel. Nokia now has like less than 3% share. And as we know, the smartphone is ubiquitous. So he already had that experience going into this new solar field. And so he told us, as the company, we're this scrappy startup. We shared a fence with Netflix. We were right next to Netflix, and Netflix bought our building. And I was like, I didn't, I wasn't seasoned enough to realize, oh, that's when you buy stock. When this company's exploding next door to the point where they're buying your building, I didn't know. I was fresh out of college. I was like, oh, cool, good for these guys, Netflix. At the time, Netflix was, they were mailing you DVDs. So I was like, whatever. I didn't know about Silicon Valley. I was in an entry-level position, fresh out of college. And but our CEO had this vision. He goes, look, in 5 years, our power electronics are going to be industry standard. And I was like, when he said that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the Intel inside of the solar industry. And I was like hooked. And I got to travel the world, and I was a part of a bunch of different really important projects for us. But it felt like I just felt kind of like out of place a little bit in the industry. The solar industry is just not, it's not sexy, it's not fun. The branding is super outdated. And I was just like, man, I want to be something, I want to do something for myself, that's like self-directed, but also more in alignment with my personal like brand and like ethos and aesthetic. So I came across Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek, and I read his book, and I was on a business trip. I was flying to Hawaii, and I'm reading his book, and I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy is articulating things that I have felt in my spirit, things that I know that are true, but from my upbringing and what I've experienced, you know, my upbringing was really tough. You know, we had a lot of hard times. And so that mentality was foreign to me. So when I saw this guy lay out in his 4-hour work week book, here, this is what you do step by step, I'm like, dude, I can do that. I can create something. I can invent something. And so that's where I started. I started in 2014. You know, I invented a gadget so that I could film myself crowd surfing at a concert. And, you know, that's where I jumped in. I launched my first product. We got some very interesting traction. We almost made it to Shark Tank. And just through the evolution of that product, we have this product now.
Yeah. So where did it start? So the first one was called Hand Snap.
Yeah.
Wait, so the first product, it was like an OtterBox accessory, right? That was like your first kind of success.
So the company is called Hand Snap Incorporated. That first product is called Hand Snap, and it was a standalone product. We did a Kickstarter. Samsung actually reached out to us. Mm-hmm. Samsung was starting a gadget app on their phone. And they're like, hey, we want this to be like this gadget app with everybody that gets a Samsung. They have this on their phone. And so if they're looking for accessories, they can just go on this app and choose accessories. We like what you're doing with Hand Snap. We want you to be one of the first gadgets. I went to Mountain View. I met with them, Samsung and Mountain View. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. And then
cool.
You know, I reached back out to him when we're starting to get closer to production, and Samsung had canceled the prep project, canceled the app, and fired the guy. And so I was like, okay, well, there's nothing there, you know? And then I tried to get on a Shark Tank. I emailed Shark Tank so many times, and they finally sent me an email that said, stop emailing us. You've already emailed us so many times or whatever. And so I emailed them one more time. And they called me, you know, I passed the interview on the call or whatever, and they considered us for the show, but we didn't make the show. So I had a lot of close wins with the first product, but over time, I was kind of losing investor interest with that product. It started to get seen as like part of the case industry, and the case industry, the phone case industry, was super commoditized, washed out. Race to the bottom, everybody's flooding the market. And, you know, it was just a tough industry. So investors were not excited about the product. So I couldn't really raise the money to give the product the attention, the resources that it needed. Mm-hmm. But in the process of wearing my phone on my hand, literally, I was like, oh, it'd be cool if I could control the phone with a remote control ring on my finger.
Yeah.
So I started developing that concept.
One moment. So how does that differentiate from the first product?
Well, the first product was like, it was basically like this articulating arm with a strap where you could wear your phone.
So kind of like a pop socket?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I was like a pop socket competitor. I hadn't heard of pop sockets.
Yeah.
And I started seeing them everywhere. And that's also part of the journey. My co-founder is now, you know, my co-founder now was the first president of Pop Sockets.
Oh, wow. Okay, cool. So it started off as a competitor to that. And then, and this happens when you start a business, right? You don't know the other competitors that exist. Right. It's only when you really get into like the meat of it, you're like, oh crap, there's like other companies doing this. And they're actually like kind of big.
Right. So, well, when we started, Pop Sockets was not big. So my start and Pop Sockets start are actually oddly similar. The Pop Sockets founder was a philosophy professor in Boulder, Colorado. And to my knowledge, he didn't have business background before that. He was an academic.
Yeah.
He came up with Pop Sockets as a way to wrap your headphone cables around the back of your phone to keep your headphones from being tangled. Mm. And he launched a Kickstarter. It was a very humble Kickstarter. They did $18,000. It took him a year to fulfill. they returned 25% of the money because they were so late that customers were like, I just want our money back. Yeah. And that was all in like 2012 or 2013.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I started this and I launched my first Kickstarter in 2015, I think maybe my first one was 2014. I can't remember, but it was a failure. It failed. And then I went back and did it again and it was a success, but it was meager. You know, we did $13,000 for our Kickstarter. Okay. So, you know, I didn't know about PopSockets. Nobody did. It was a local Colorado brand. It wasn't until my partner joined PopSockets that they went national and yeah. they did something, you know, really, really meaningful with the company by, I think, 2016 or something like that. They went from, you know, a local regional brand to a national brand, but, you know, by the time I was inventing it, it wasn't out there. It didn't exist like that.
Okay. So I'm curious more about the journey here. Okay. So you started this first product. Did you quit your job at this point? Were you still doing something? Were you going all in? What was the situation like?
So I worked at the solar company for 3 years. I did this, you know, I did my startup on the side and I worked for this company for 3 years. And it was really tough because the Silicon Valley company was it's just a really, really hard industry. They call the solar industry the solar coaster. Mm-hmm. Because of so many ups and downs. I mean, it was like 1 year overnight, almost all of the American and European solar companies went out of business because China decided to jump into the business and start making every solar panel.
Yeah.
The governments would pour in subsidies, you know, a green government would come in and say, hey, we're gonna subsidize the solar industry. And then the subsidies would go away. There was just a lot of the solar industry in general is just brutal. The margins are super thin. It's just a tough industry. So I was definitely getting burnt out on that. And I was like, you know, burning the candle at both ends, trying to get my startup off the ground.
Yeah.
And it was just really hard to do that. My CEO, who I'm still very good terms with, still very friendly with, we still talk. He told me, he's like, hey, look, I just want to like warn you that I know you're doing your startup and we can't tell you not to do your startup, but I want you to be careful because you could end up with nothing. If you put too much attention into your own startup, he's basically saying through the lines, like you could get fired here.
Yeah.
And your startup could not be successful because startups are hard and most of them are not successful.
Yeah.
So he was kind of like, you know, we were friends. We had a great relationship. I worked for him directly. But it was like, I'm like, oh shoot. You know, like I do have to be careful.
Yeah.
And then I ended up getting laid off, which had nothing to do with my startup. It was just, you know, I got laid off with six other people. There had been six rounds of layoffs already. And I had made it through all these different layoffs because like I was so early with the company and I was so committed. But eventually I just got laid off with a bunch of other people. And I kind of got to the point where I was like, well, look, I'm laid off now. I don't have a job anyway. So I got my startup that I've been trying to get off the ground. And now I've got this opportunity to give it all of my energy. So.
And what year was this?
2017.
Okay. So when was the Ring product invented? Was that 2017?
The Ring was actually invented in 2016, I think.
But this is around the time you got laid off from your job. This is when you started working more so on the Ring, right? Is that right?
Well, not technically. I was still trying to do the hand snap, the original product.
Yeah.
And I ended up I just ended up stitching together, working, you know, getting investors and raising enough money to like pay myself enough to like keep going. Yeah. And, you know, eventually that we kind of phased out the hand snap product. We built the ring. I built the first prototype of the ring where I could wear it. It was a wearable. I was, you know, controlling my media with this ring. Mm-hmm. And I ended up meeting my partner now at just some kind of investor event. Somebody's like, hey, I know the guy that launched PopSockets. And by that time, I'd been seeing PopSockets everywhere. I'm like, dude, these guys are a massive success. They're largely doing what I set out to do. Yeah. So if you can't beat them, join them. I'm like, hey, to this person, I'm like, hey, I want to meet that guy. If that guy launched PopSockets, yeah, I want what he has. And so I met with him. I showed him the ring and he goes, oh my gosh, this could be PopSockets part two. Because what they found with PopSockets was it was the designs that were attracting teenagers. Their yeah. whole business model was around having fun designs and attracting young people to the designs.
For sure.
And he's like, dude, this could be PopSockets part two. And he jumped in. We did the ring. We launched the ring.
Hold on a second. Where yeah. did the idea of the ring come from? So you kind of got into this but earlier, but it was like, you were just thinking one day, like this would be a cool product. Did you get inspiration from anything?
So when I was wearing the hand snap, so let's say like I'm wearing, you know, I'm holding the PopSockets like this and yeah. I'm wearing the hand snap kind of like this. And mm-hmm. I was like, it's cool that I can film with one hand, yeah. but I can't control anything that I'm filming with. I can't start and stop the video. I can't take a picture. So if I was wearing a control on my index finger, then I can do that.
Yeah.
And that's where the idea came from. And eventually it just became a standalone product. You know, we discontinued the first product and we went all in on the ring because the ring is basically the same concept as what we're doing with the snap clip. It's yeah. your active lifestyle. You're a content creator. You're in the gym. You're doing something with your life where you need additional tools to, you know, help you be disconnected, so to speak.
Okay. Yeah. So you team up with the former president of PopSocket, and this is like, is this before you launched a ring or is this during like the prototype phase?
This was during the prototype phase.
Yeah. Did he just drop what he was doing basically and work with you, or what was that like?
No, you know, he's had previous success. He did the PopSockets thing. He's been involved in a lot of different successful businesses. Mm-hmm. So he saw the potential of the ring, but he didn't jump in full time.
Yeah.
He vetted me. He vetted the project. We started working together, you know, and eventually over time, he just carved out enough margin so that he could focus the amount of energy that he needed to focus on the ring.
So what happened with the ring then? So you start working together, you have this cool prototype, turns into a product. What happened?
So the ring was really challenging. The ring took us a couple years to develop. We had to get it small enough so that teenagers would wear it. And miniaturizing electronics is very challenging.
Yeah.
Making a wearable, making a jewelry is very challenging. Mm-hmm. So it was really hard. And we ended up launching it. My partner had a connection with this store in London, inside of Selfridges. So Selfridges is voted the world's number one department store in the world 4 years in a row.
Yeah.
And so we got this opportunity to launch in this technology store inside the Selfridges. Yeah. It fell flat. It didn't work. We didn't make any sales. We got connected with an influencer who had like 1.2 million followers. Jackie Rivera, shout out to Jackie. She's really great person and fun to work with. We did a holiday campaign and we sold 100 rings. Mm-hmm. And it was cool. It was like, you know, we're in business now. We're, you know, we have something to work on. We're shipping out snap rings. And we did this really cool, like custom box kit where she signed 50 of them, you know, custom design with her photography on the outside of the packaging. this is really fun, like boutique sort of thing. So we're like, cool. We kind of like proved a business model of sorts, but we realized we're like, look, the sizing aspect of the ring is really challenging. It's an inventory nightmare. Our cost of goods on the ring was really expensive, you know, where margins were not good. Yeah. And so in that process of the ring, you know, one of my favorite quotes that Steve Jobs quoted all the time was, something is perfect when nothing more can be taken away from it. So the concept is, instead of like, oh, I've added this product and let's see how many gadgets and doodads and things we can add to it. Let's see how much we can simplify it. And until the very last detail is removed from it, we have this perfect product. So when we were making the ring had three buttons. It was size dependent. It had all these constraints. It was expensive. And now with the snap clip, I pruned as much functionality from the ring as I could into a single button. And now the button is universal. It's not size dependent. You can wear it anywhere. You can turn it into a keychain. It's a very just versatile, very simple, very cost-effective product.
Yeah, absolutely. So you launched the ring in 2017, right?
Well, we actually launched the ring in like the end of 2019.
I see. Okay. So you worked on it for a few years.
Yeah. Yeah. We launched it. We launched it in December of 2019 in London, right before the pandemic hit. So the pandemic hits, we did an influencer campaign during the pandemic. You know, the pandemic was obviously a nightmare for so many people. And it was just a very tough environment to keep a hardware startup going. Yeah. And that was also a big push for us to be like, look, the cost of goods, the inventory during the pandemic, you know, we need to be lean. We need to be simple. We need to have a product that's more universal, that has better margins, that's easier to understand, easier to approach. You know, a ring, it's like when you have jewelry, you kind of limit yourself to women. Some guys wear jewelry, but you know, I've got these big gaudy earrings right now. But like most guys don't wear jewelry. So you're limiting your market. And then we only offered four sizes. Boom. You just limited your market again. So it's like we had to, the cost of goods, the limitations, all this stuff, we had to get creative and we had to pivot. And, you know, we created a new product. And this new product, SnapClip, just quickly started getting attention and traction. And it's because of this whole crazy, long, windy, just challenging journey that I've been on, that we've made relationships, we've been seasoned. You know, my partner's been much more seasoned than me in the physical product space. He's got 20 years experience. But you know, now we're like, we've been working together for a few years. We have a really good relationship. Now we know what to do. Now we know what we want to do. We've got a roadmap that we're excited about, and we're going to take over the world with SnapClips.
Yeah. So you launched a product in January of this year. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, technically, you know, we were in a couple little mom and pop stores last December. So it was almost 10 months to the day that we went from our first mom and pop shop to 622 Best Buys.
Yeah. And you talk about getting traction and attention. What does that look like? What were some of the things that have been different with this launch compared to your past launches with the previous products that makes you more confident, like, yeah, this is going to work? And also to get the attention of big retailers. Like, how do you start this? Like, how did it start really this year?
It's a, you know, your friends and family are kind of a double-edged sword, because they want you, they love you, they want you to be successful. So, but you can also tell when they're holding back or when they don't get a product, you know?
Yeah.
So with the snap clip, our first round, when we're showing friends and family, and a lot of friends and family are like, you know, some of them are like very seasoned people themselves. It's not just random people with no, you know, marketing and no background. Like some of these are like vetted people. Yeah. We just got a very different response with the snap clip from them. And that, okay, that enabled us to be like, okay, cool. We have something different. We're getting different responses from before. If you've got honest friends and family, you know, that's even more helpful. People that are just like, dude, I don't really get this product. I don't see it. I don't see a personal use for it. I don't see, like, I just don't get it, you know? So this product had a very different response. So we're like, cool. Okay. Now take it to the next step, show it to some other people. We showed it to our investor.
I'm really curious here. Do you make like 100 of them or 50 of them just to see, or one or two?
So we actually made a few prototypes. I have a 3D printer in my bedroom.
Okay, so, cool.
You know,
of course you do.
So, you know, we made some prototypes. One of my designers, or, you know, our main designer has been a partner of mine since the very beginning. Johnny's just been an incredible designer to work with. He has the combined experience of making 3D rendered designs that can be printable, but also making just incredibly beautiful 3D design renderings, like graphic designs.
Yeah.
So the combination of having, you know, a physical 3D product that you can show somebody, and also these beautiful renderings of what it would look like, you know, on a shelf or in its highest, like its most glorious, like, version of it. You know, people saw that and they really like resonated with it.
So it wasn't functioning at this point. You just had like a prototype of what it looked like and how it functioned.
So we had a prototype, and then we got something off the shelf that was close enough to where we could design around it.
Nice.
So, so we took something off the shelf, you know, we designed our components that went to it so we can actually physically wear it, test it out. As soon as we saw that people were interested, I made a pitch video. I sent it to our investor. So our one of our investors is the owner of the Kit Kat clock, which is the clock with the eyes that go back and forth. It's the iconic American, you know, it's been around since the 20s.
Yeah.
So we pitched to him. We're like, hey, we've got this idea. You know, I was a little bit nervous because I'm like, we just did this ring that took a long time, and I don't want to appear like I'm being, you know, distracted, but we're kind of putting a pause on the ring and we want to do this other thing. And he's like, oh my gosh, I love it. He immediately put in an order for 100,000 units. And we're like, we kind of thought like, I don't know. We got on the phone with him next week just to see if like it was real, you know?
Yeah.
So we get on the phone with him next week and he goes, you guys, I don't think you understood me. I want to buy 100,000 units from you. And we're like, okay, this is real. This is real. So he paid for them, and that got us up and running. And once that hit, once we realized like, oh, somebody's willing to put in an order for 100,000 units, we're like, this is big time. This is go time. We're not, you know, we're not focused on like onesie twosie sales. Oh, let's keep learning. We believe that this is an international product. And we're going to treat it like that. So okay, we immediately started looking at opportunities to break into big box retail. And now we're in Best Buy.
So he buys 100,000 units. And so does he have his own retail stores, or what was he going to do with them?
He does have his own retail stores. Yeah. So the Kit Kat clock is inside 2,000 locations in the United States. So one of our snap clips actually has the licensed Kit Kat, you know, the iconic cat print on the snap clip.
Nice.
But he found, just like we did, that new products aren't that simple. You can't just put new products in a store and everybody gets it. There's still a learning curve. There's still a process. I mean, I just came from our local Best Buy here in town. I'm in Santa Cruz, California. And I physically went into the store and set up our display for them. I talked to the manager this morning and he's like, "Hey man, I can't find it. I don't think it's here. I don't think your display is here." And he just kept going back and looking. He eventually came back with the display in a, you know, the shipping box that it came in.
Yeah.
I unpacked it and I physically set it up in the store and I put all of our inventory on the display. We've got this beautiful 5 foot tall display right in the center of the store, right in the mobile department. It's the best placement in the store. But even in that, like if I wasn't there today, who knows? It could have been weeks before it went up inside the store.
Yeah. So the 100,000 units, are those going in Best Buy then?
So it's still to be determined. I mean,
Was the Best Buy, is that a separate order?
That's a separate order. Yeah. The Best Buy is our account.
Okay. So you have the 100,000 units that you, that the guy paid for, and you don't know where they're going yet.
Right.
Then you have another order from Best Buy. Are you allowed to say how many they bought?
They bought 55,000 units.
Okay, so Best Buy buys 55,000 units. This guy buys 100,000 units. So I'm curious, how did Best Buy come across the product?
So we, my partner's got a, because he's been in
course,
in you know, retail for 20 years, he's got a lot of just network connections, people that just kind of like flow through the network.
Yeah. And
one of the people that flowed through the network was this really good rep group, this sales group, that has a strong relationship with Best Buy. They saw SnapClip. They understood it immediately. And he goes, "Look, man, you guys have morsels of gold. These are morsels of gold. These need to be in every single Best Buy."
Yeah.
And he's like, "Look, the phone accessories market is commoditized. It's boring. There's no innovation there. What you guys are bringing to Best Buy, you're actually doing them a favor. You're bringing them value. You are helping them differentiate themselves from other retailers." And he immediately got the vision and he was just like, just, you know, fired up to get in front of Best Buy and to, you know, just go after it.
That's amazing how you can have like this like small success for like a period of years, and then you're like, "Aha, I have this idea," and all of a sudden, within months of coming up with the prototype, you've people place orders in of 150,000 units, which is probably somewhere north of $1 million in revenue. So yeah, that's really impressive. And I don't know, it's just one of those things where it's like, it kind of leaves you kind of speechless. You're like, "Dang." But for you, it's been a long time coming.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been a long time coming. And a big part of this journey has been a lot of soul searching. Like, why am I doing this? There's a lot of ways to make money. There's
Can we talk about that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, so, you know, being an entrepreneur, I've been an entrepreneur like almost for the last 5 years. You've been an entrepreneur for years, more than me. You know, what's that journey really been like internally?
Brutal. In a word, brutal. I mean, ultimately, what I recognize was, I've been working on this product, I've been working on this company, but this company has been working on me. Like, you know, it might sound cliche or whatever, cheesy, but I'm realizing that it's forged a character in me that now, like, I can't undo. You know, the person I am today, I'm a different person, and I'm grateful for who I am now, because of how challenging the journey's been. And so many points in the journey, I'm like, why am I doing this? This is really hard. Like, why do I get up each morning? And I recognize, like, there's a lot of ways to make money. There's a million things I could be doing with my life. why am I choosing this thing? And the answer that I came up with was, it's part of my identity. I was an inventor when I was a little kid. I derive joy out of creating things. It's just part of who I am. And so rather than chasing money or chasing, you know, like whatever success, I'm now chasing something different. I'm chasing self-actualization. I'm chasing identity. I'm chasing becoming the best possible version that I could be. I'm on a different path now. And I believe that the outcome of that path will be great products, will be success, will be financial compensation. But it's only through chasing that highest value that these other values are added to you, rather than the other way around, you know, chasing money and chasing all these things. And you end up, your soul just dries up, and it's like, you know, it's not healthy.
For sure. And, you know, there's been countless stories of like, oh, you know, I chased the money, and whether you got the money or not, it didn't really create that sense of fulfillment. And what I say is, you know, it's not something that I've learned along my journey is that it's not necessarily like, sure, it's great to have goals and have ideas of where we want to get to. And I think it's important as a successful entrepreneur to make a lot of money, and that deems a lot of a product success. But at the same time, it's not about that. It's about who we become in the process.
Absolutely.
So my question for you on top of that would be like, who do you feel like you've become in the process? Like, dang, like you started this 8 years ago. It wasn't until like last year that, or this year, that things really started taking off. Like, who are you now versus who you were?
I think part of it is rediscovery in a lot of ways. You know, like I listen to and follow Jesus. And when Jesus says to turn and become like a child, like I take that literally. Yeah. And who I'm becoming today is who I've always been. You know, like I want to be more like the best version of child like me.
We're coming back to who we are.
Basically. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you grow up and you're a kid and you're not worried about money, because the world works somehow. You don't know how it works. You don't care how it works. You're a kid. You're in the moment. You're with your friends. You're doing things that you enjoy just because you love being in that moment of enjoying that. And then somewhere along the way, somebody says, oh, you have to go do this thing. You have to go get an education, or else you're going to be a loser and you're going to be poor for the rest of your life. And then so you chase this education. You know, I got a STEM degree. I got a degree in biology that I don't regret, because I love science, but it's not my path. Yeah. I got that degree out of fear. I got that degree not out of, I did get it out of love. I love science, but like there was too much fear in it. There was too much fear, you know, and you're going down the path and the world tells you this and society tells you that, and you get all these messages. And like, when you go through the hardships in life, you wonder, what is life about? Why am I here? Who am I? Why is anybody here? It's like, it's the Matrix, you know? You're like, wait, holy crap, we're a bunch of conscious beings just ambling around trying to like stay alive. Is that the meaning of life, is to stay alive? You start really asking yourself tough questions, and you realize there's not a lot of people that have good answers for these questions that I'm asking. And then you start to feel even more lonely. You're like, oh my gosh, it's worse than I thought. When I was a kid, I thought adults had it figured out. Now that I'm adult, I realize that most of these people are phoning in their lives. They don't know why they're here. They don't know why they exist. They don't have these answers. They just keep going every day, day in and day out. One of my favorite movies recently was the, I'm blanking on it, the AR movie, the augmented reality movie with Ryan Reynolds, where he puts on the glasses and he sees this augmented reality, and everybody's walking around and they're NPCs, they're non-playable characters. Have you seen this movie?
Hold on, I'm looking it up right now.
Is it Free Guy?
Free Guy, there we go.
Free Guy, mind-blowing movie. One of the most hopeful. Oh, we got all these scientific sci-fi movies that are like dystopian, right? And it's like, oh my God, Blade Runner and Bat, you know, all these things are just like so dark and like future is scary. Free Guy is like, dude, let's make the future what we want it to be. We can control, we can create our own destiny. We can create the world that we want the world to be like.
Yeah.
And he encounters all these NPCs, all these non-playable characters around him, people that are just going through the motions. This is what somebody else told me to do, so this is what I'm doing. And he like breaks out of the mold and he becomes alive. He becomes sentient. He gains higher levels of consciousness. He ascends to a level of self-mastery and self-actualization, and he wakes up other non-playable characters that go and take that journey with him. It's a mind-blowingly beautiful movie, and that's the journey that I've been on these last couple of years, is like, who am I and why the hell am I here? Yeah, of course we're gonna sell millions of these gadgets. Mm-hmm. Is that a success? Is that gonna like unlock my next destiny? Yeah, sure, that's going to be cool. But like, if I'm tapped into my identity of who I am, if I'm self-actualized and I'm living up to my highest potential of my being, that is where I'm going to be fulfilled. That's where joy is going to come from. It's not because, you know, I've bought an island somewhere and, you know, everybody knows my name and everybody's bought my products, because there are so many lonely, miserable, wealthy people who are just locked away in their ivory towers. They have no friends and family and relationships. Everybody knows who they are, but nobody actually knows who they are. So that's not the journey that I'm on. I need to have a healthy life where I've got healthy relationships and healthy hobbies. I'm going out into nature. My relationship with my wife is good. My homies are still there for me. I'm still there for them. Like I'm loving every moment of life. I love my work. I love creating things. That's what I'm going after.
I love that. It's about living in the present moment, man. How can we enjoy every day?
Yep.
Right. And I think all these that you talk about, like, how do you work on yourself, not just when you're working? You know what I mean? What are all those other things that you're doing? The hobby, the relationships, going into nature. I'm just curious, like, what are some of the strategies that, like, after all these years as an entrepreneur, what are some of like the life strategies, you know, to work for you?
I've got very simple daily regimens that keep me in alignment. They're very simple. I go to bed every night at the same time. I wake up every morning at the same time. All science tells you that. Monday through Friday, that's what I do.
Yeah.
I keep my phone off until 10 a.m. in the morning.
What time do you look at?
6:45.
Mm-hmm.
I don't look at what the world is telling me. I start my day deciding who I am and what I'm going to tell the world. I do not look at my phone until 10 in the morning.
Yep.
I turn off my phone at 8 o'clock at night. I put it in airplane mode and I put it in my bedroom. I don't look at my phone after 8 o'clock at night. In the mornings, I journal. I do my morning pages. You know, I journal each morning. I have mantras that I write out reminding me who I am, reminding me where I'm going, reminding me that I have an audience of one. I seek to live in the highest version of myself to an audience of my creator. And I write out, if I had a tough day the day before, I don't let those emotions fester. I work through those emotions. Why did that bother me? What is the best outcome? Who is the person that I want to be? How do I respond to the world? And then from that point, I eat a high density protein breakfast I set my objectives for the day, mostly professional, some personal. I work through the day, and then, you know, towards the evening, I have some kind of physical activity. I'm in the gym, I'm on my mountain bike. And sometimes it's crunch time, you know, this Best Buy, working with Best Buy, it's taken us 7 months from introduction to them to product being on the floor. So mm-hmm. there's a certain level of tenacity that comes with following a project through at that level. And so I had to break up my day. I worked during the day. I would do something active outside, outdoors in the middle, you know, towards the end of the day. And then I'd have a night shift, and I would be working with our manufacturers at night in Asia. And, you know, and then I would have a shut off time, and I would connect with my wife, you know? So there are certain days during crunch time that I need to work more hours than a typical day. But that can't be my life, because I've already done that and it breaks down. It's not you're not running a marathon, you're running a sprint. And so you need to break up those sprints. You need to isolate those sprints. You can't live your life like it's a sprint. You know, even professional legendary athletes, you know, they know when to call it a day, when they're breaking down their muscle fiber and their muscle tissue, when they're actually injuring their body. Your body builds itself up during rest. So I take a Sabbath every week. Sometimes it's Saturday, sometimes it's Sunday. Some Saturdays or Sundays, I'll keep my phone in airplane mode the entire day. I'll do 36 hours with no internet. We'll take a walk. We'll go to the movies. We'll read a book. We'll hang out with friends, hot tub, sauna. Like, it's just absolute relaxation. No thoughts about work whatsoever. Complete brain rest.
Yeah.
And I've honed these disciplines as a result of doing it the other way. When I was working for the tech company, the Silicon Valley company, and I was doing my own startup, I got myself into a very bad place. I had no discipline. Nobody was telling me, hey man, you need to have boundaries. Hey, you need to have personal boundaries. I didn't know what that meant. Nobody's encouraging me to do that. You know, my CEO, I was getting positive reinforcement for being on the clock, around the clock. Like, I was getting recognized because I was working harder and longer than most other people. And that's the kind of that perpetual, always on performance is kind of an addiction in Silicon Valley that is rewarded. Oh, I'm working so hard. You know, the guy that founded Pandora went to the hospital multiple times because he thought he was having a heart attack, but it was panic. Right. The doctor's like, hey, man, you're fine. Like, go home and sleep, you know, and these stories, I don't think that story was heralded as like a good thing, but these stories kind of collect like a low key, like badge of honor, you know? Oh, I wore myself so thin. I'm so sold out for this thing or that thing. And it's very, very unhealthy. And for every Pandora that has a $3 billion exit, the way that Pandora did, how many people burned out? How many people died? I mean, Japan literally has a word for people that die at work. Japan, in a lot of ways, is what America is looking at our future if we don't course correct.
Yeah.
Japan, in a lot of ways, is this beautiful, incredible, technologically advanced, incredible culture. And in a lot of ways, it's very unhealthy. Very isolated, very, you know, they're making AI robots, and people are having relationships with AI chatbots, and like, and they're not repopulating themselves. They don't have interest in sex with a human being. Parts of their culture, right? In those segments of their culture, that's very unhealthy. That's very out of balance. So like, you know, we need to take a warning from these people that have completely imploded their lives and like turn around and do something different. So well-being is very important to me. You know, well-being is kind of this new buzzword, but it's real. Like, if you're dead, you're not well. And so part of our mission of our company is like, stay in the flow, stay away from your phone, put your phone down. Like,
which is ironic, but it makes sense, actually. It makes
it's very ironic. It's hilarious. And we're going to get called out for it. And I welcome it, because all press is good press. We want people to be in the flow. Like, I'm a musician. I was in a band for a long time. Like, I'm obsessed with music. And music is like my, like the antidote for the grind of the day. So when I'm doing something I don't enjoy, I can't do it unless I've got music.
Yeah.
And if I'm doing something I can enjoy and I have music, I want anything to distract me. And if I have my snap clip, I stay in focus. I'm like, my phone's over there. I'm not looking at it. I need to work on this financial model. I need to work on this, whatever this thing's stressing me out. And I need music in my ears, and I need to stay in the flow until this thing's done.
Yeah. I love how we all just kind of like tied it back to your own personal philosophy. You know what I mean? I think it's great.
Thank you. Thank you.
So we're almost out of time here, but I have, you know, one last question for you. And let's pretend it's the end of your life and you did everything that you wanted to do, though everything has been destroyed. There's nothing left to show for your life. And all you can do is leave the people with three truths you know about the world. What would they be?
That's the craziest question I've ever heard an interview ask anyone.
You could take your time.
Holy moly. Three truths. Wow. Three truths. Nothing exists anymore. Hold on. Let me try to understand your question. You're asking me, if I'm at the end of my life, everything I've ever accomplished was accomplished, and I could leave the people that I care about with three truths.
Yeah. And on top of that, I said, though everything has been destroyed, there's nothing left to show for your life.
Everything, there's nothing left to show for your life. I mean, honestly, that's where we're all going.
Yeah.
So there's a term called amor fati. I think maybe
Nietzsche, love your fate, right?
There you go. Is everything that comes down our path, for good or for bad, embrace it all. The Stoics say that the obstacle is the course. So whatever is in front of you, the obstacle is the way. Whatever is in front of you, just fully embrace it and charge through it. So ultimately, we embrace our fate. We're all going to die.
Mm-hmm.
So the more that you embrace that every single day, the more you realize that, the less you're going to care what people think about you. So maybe that's the first one, is you're going to die. Don't, you know, care less about what people think about you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm wearing these earrings right now. They're gold earrings with anchors in them. Mm-hmm. And I was in an In-N-Out in Northern California, and I was thinking about quitting business because I was so frustrated. And these two young people came up to me, a guy and a girl in their early 20s, and they said, "Hey, man, this sounds weird, but sometimes God speaks to us, and he's sharing something about you with us right now. Can we share that with you?" And I'm like, I'm like, "Yeah, man, please."
Yeah.
And they said a few things. One of the things they said was, "You're a strategic business leader who's good to his employees." And I'm like, dude, I'm like, I'm about to quit my business. I got one employee and it's me, and I'm not treating myself very well. You know, I didn't say any of that to him, but I'm like, whoa. And they go, "You see those earrings in your ear, the anchors? I want you, God is sharing with me that you need to be anchored to what God says about you, and not what you say about what yourself, and not what other people say about you." And I was like, yo, you know, you have somebody in clear blue day in a burger joint walking up to you and telling you things about your life that there's no way they could know, and telling you to, you know, listen to God's thoughts about you. Like, that got my attention. You know what I mean? Yeah. And so I think that would be the second thing that I would say is listen to what God says about you, and not what you say about yourself, and not what other people say about you, is mm-hmm. because, you know, we grow up and other people don't treat us right. And yeah. sometimes it's our own parents, you know, that they don't treat you right, and society doesn't treat you right, and bullies on the playground, and on and on and on and on. And so you're tempted to believe, oh, other people didn't treat me right, so that must mean that I'm not valuable. That must mean that I'm not good enough. That must mean that da, 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 da. And I believe that God is whispering to every single one of us, is saying, that's not who you are. I made you in my image. Humans are made in the image of God. And so that voice that speaks, that breathes that life into you, listen to that voice. Tune out your own ego and all the things that you've learned. Tune out all the things that other people say, that you can't do this, that, or the other thing, and listen to that voice.
I love it, man.
And the thing that ties it all together is love. That's, you know, it's trite, it's Hallmark, it's truth. It's the only thing that is true, is mm-hmm. love.
Is that number three?
That's number three.
I love it, man. Great stuff. I love how this conversation, we started off kind of like, you know, just with the business, and then we got into, you know, more of your life philosophy and getting to know who you are as a person and tying it back. It's been a lot of fun, man. And I'm glad we did this.
Well, I appreciate you, Alec. I appreciate your time. I appreciate your insightful questions. You did your homework, you know, that you had thoughtful questions.
Yeah.
And that last question is quite a doozy. Yeah. So keep asking people that.
Yeah. I appreciate it, man.